The sponsor of this week's episode of the Mobile Dev Memo podcast is Clarisites. Tired of waiting for updates to slow dashboards that don't tell you the complete story? Tired of manually aggregating data on spreadsheets to understand your campaign performance? What if you could access all the data you need in one place without dependencies on SQL, spreadsheets, or valuable data team resourcing? That's why performance marketers at Uber, HelloFresh, Delivery Hero, and many others trust Clarisites to run marketing reporting, automating all manual work and helping them focus on insights that drive performance. What used to take weeks now takes minutes with Clarisites. Go to clarisites.com/demo to try it out for free. You'll see why thousands of performance marketers trust Clarisites every day.
The problem is that the distinction needs to be drawn between the competence of the economists and the correctness of their analysis.
Welcome to the Mobile Dev Memo podcast. I'm your host, Eric Sufer. In this week's episode of the podcast, I am discussing the use of econometrics in marketing with Dr. Grace Kite. Grace, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Really nice to be here.
Well, it's very nice to have you. And I have no doubt that we are going to have a very fruitful and fascinating discussion. But before we get to the use of econometrics in marketing, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, yeah, I'm Grace Kite. I'm the founder of Magic Numbers and Magic Works. And together, those companies provide people-friendly analytics, econometrics, and also practical training in effectiveness and marketing.
And we have something sort of in common. So you did your PhD. So first, you have a PhD. You did your PhD at SOAS. Am I remembering that correctly?
That's right.
And I did my master's degree at UCL. So we shared a little corner of London, very, very close to each other, the SOAS library and the UCL main campus.
Just down the road. We could have passed each other on the way to the pub.
We might have. And little known fact, Christopher Nolan went to UCL and he filmed parts of the first movie in his Batman franchise. He filmed quite a bit of it in the SOAS library.
I did not know that. Now I've spent quite a bit of time in there and I've never seen any Batman.
No. A lot of stressed out students, but probably no Batman.
Yeah.
Okay. So to kick off the conversation, I usually start these with just like a big high concept question. So at a conceptual level, what is the use case of econometrics as a discipline in marketing? What are the ways that it is utilized by marketing teams to make decisions?
So the big picture answer to your big picture question there is, what are we going to do when third-party cookies are gone? And that's the big important use case for econometrics right now in 2024. Without third-party cookies, we're going to be really restricted in what we can do in multi-touch attribution, and algorithms are going to be restricted to using some sort of last-click like signals in some places. And that means they won't be able to identify the role of ads that happen earlier in the purchase journey. So you do a TV ad or a YouTube ad, someone watches it, and then later on they click on a search ad before buying. We're going to get back into that kind of situation where we're allocating credit more to the search ad than it should be. And econometrics comes into the breach, right? Because it can measure what top funnel ads do without cookies. So that's really the big picture use case of it.
Well, without cookies and without the IDFA or the GAID, right, which is already, that restriction's already been imposed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. So I remember I was working, you talk about just over-attributing to the biggest channel, right? So I did a project sort of like before, when ATT was announced, but before it went into effect. And we actually had a PhD on this team. And we were talking about like the sort of model adaptation to the loss of the IDFA. And this person was like, well, Eric, what do you think about this? Because like they had been fighting this battle internally. If we switch to just kind of like pure play media mix modeling, won't just Facebook get all the credit? And I was like, well, yeah, that's going to be a problem. You're going to have to accommodate for that. Like probably like that's, especially if that's like the bulk of the historical data set, certainly you have to accommodate for that. And it's like, well, how do we accommodate for that? Well, that's the job. Like that's the task. That's like media mix models. You get one off the shelf, but the task is tuning it right and making sure that it's reflective.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that makes for, it wasn't planned. It makes for a good segue into the next question, which is historically, I think digital first marketers and I get in trouble for this because I talk about like the emerging marketing economist, and people are like, well, what rock have you been living under? This is my job. And this has been my job for 30 years. I work in CPG. And I'm like, okay, fine. But I live in the digital realm, right? And then in the digital realm, digital first marketers have viewed marketing measurement as a purely deterministic counting exercise, right? And so data signal degradation has challenged that model, that operational model, that mental model. And the privacy environment is not getting less restrictive, right? It's getting more restrictive over time. It's things will never be better than they are right now in terms of like data availability, right? So how can marketers navigate the unknown problem of shifting from deterministic to probabilistic or econometric measurement?
So, I mean, it is a challenge, but it's a good challenge in my mind, because first of all, privacy, and sometimes we forget this because we talk about privacy like it's this movement to privacy is a bad thing, and it kind of is for us. But actually, people out there don't want to be followed around the internet, don't want to be snooped upon. And they already see our industry as a bit of a pain in the bum, getting in the way of the programs and podcasts and surfing that they want to do. So if we care about advertising as a whole, we have to kind of do it in a way that doesn't upset people. So I think it's a really good challenge to have. What econometrics does is it looks at sales over time, all the trends and spikes and dips, and it matches them up to corresponding trends and spikes and dips in things that cause sales to change. And that's advertising of all types, but also price, the weather, and a whole range of other things that are happening. And it uses statistics to do that. So that's where the answers that you get are an estimate rather than actually a counted number of things. And so what that means is that what we're going to end up getting if we move to econometrics is a kind of looser estimate of the right thing rather than a precise estimate of kind of sometimes the wrong thing. So knowing within plus or minus 10% what your ad did to drive sales that wouldn't have come anyway is kind of much better than knowing exactly how many people happen to click on an ad in their purchase journey, because that's not as much of a useful thing to know. Because the sales that wouldn't have come anyway, those are the ones you want to optimize for, right? Those are the ones that get you growth. And I guess the advice I'd give, because you said like how is it different and what skills do people need to learn, is that if you've got a kind of MTA shaped hole in your life, it doesn't mean you need to replace it with something that's MTA shaped, because the replacement likely isn't a platform-based tool solely that only needs to know what you spent. With a probabilistic model, you need to know your knowledge as the marketer and the person that sits in that business about how the world works has to be baked into this probabilistic model. It needs to know about everything. So it needs to know things like, I sell umbrellas, the rain matters, or I sell subscriptions to a diet app. Health professionals advising people to lose weight matters. And so an econometric model will include all of those things, and the analysts will need to get a steer from you as the marketer on which are most important and what that list should include. So there has to be a dialogue between your team as the people who know the world that this business works in and the analysts who are sort of skilled craftsmen or women and building models, because they're the experts of turning all that knowledge into a quantified map of how to get sales growth.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. And I actually don't think it gets raised enough, right? So if you are, to borrow your phrase, if you have an MTA shaped hole in your life, your marketing journey has been supported by like a very specific set of data, a lot of which has been supplied by the platforms that you use, right? Mm-hmm. And you didn't really need to think about exogenous factors to that project. The project was, I use this platform, they go find me users that have demonstrated some sort of affinity or some sort of proclivity or some sort of purchase intent. They find that, they do that. I don't need to know that. I don't need to worry about that. I assume they're going to do that well. And if they don't, then that'll be apparent in my metrics, right? And so the data I need is provided by them. That's it. I've got one data pipeline. Well, now, if I can no longer depend on that, I can no longer assume that they're going to be very good at finding those users with some sort of demonstrated ability to buy or intent to buy or proclivity to buying, that type of thing. I actually need a much more diverse set of data to make decisions, right? Because it's going to depend on a lot of factors outside of that platform's user level knowledge of people, which it no longer has, right? It's like, oh, is this the right season to be advertising to this? Right? Or geographically, is there any sort of like predisposition in one place relative to another? Like, where should I be concentrating? Because if you're going out and finding the buyers, it does all of that stuff is probably less important than just knowing that this is a buyer, right? All of that stuff is lower priority or it carries lower signal. But if I don't have that anymore, all of this stuff that seemed just totally irrelevant before becomes the principal way in which I make decisions, or one of the principal inputs into the model. And a lot of teams have no ability to collate that. Like, they have no ability to aggregate it. They don't even know where you'd get that. And I feel like that MTA shaped hole is actually just reflecting the hole in the process that you used to use. It's not reflecting the hole in the data, which is much larger, because the data set, all of that trend data and sort of macro data, exogenous data, that was all sort of inherent in the buyer signal, which you no longer have. So it's not like, well, you lose the buyer signal, you lose all the other signals that were amalgamated into the buyer signal.
I love that way of thinking about it. And I think that's really, really cool explanation for it. And whether it's the strength of the buyer signal, depending on all those things in the outside world, you didn't have to think about, well, should I be doing things differently in January versus March, because mm-hmm. you had all of that coming through to you in the signals that you're getting. But if you're not getting those signals, then actually there is a time of year where it's better to do certain things. And there is a kind of outside world economy, say, where actually sometimes you might want to pull back because the economy is not so good as it was this quarter.
Right.
So all those kind of things start to be part of your thinking process and your plan going forward.
Right. And I think one of the issue that people have in making this transition, I have one more question I want to ask about reluctance here, but let me just touch on this first, is people overestimated the degree to which this deterministic targeting and deterministic attribution was really effective. I mean, I think people generally believed that this was perfect, right? But it wasn't perfect. I mean, there was just this overestimation of the precision that was provided by deterministic attribution, which I think leads people to believe maybe that the gap is larger than it is when you shift to probabilistic, because inherent in using probabilistic attribution is, like you said, is not providing a single number. That doesn't make sense, right? So when you're doing a counting exercise versus a probability exercise, I mean, it's like you talk to people, I think maybe like a good, a helpful analogy here is like, if you talk about probability distributions, you're always talking about the area between two points. You're never talking about a single point. The single point is zero. The single point of landing on any probability distribution is zero, because this is not a discrete series. It's, you know, it's a continuous series. So you're always talking about the space between two points, right? And that's a really difficult thing when you do kind of like dig into the space academically. It's like, it's kind of like a really hard thing to wrap your head around. The probability of landing on some specific point on a probability is zero, because there's no specific point. You go down infinitely in terms of decimal point. And so that's the way this kind of information is presented. It's like, well, here's a range, here's a, you know, an interval. But with counting, it's like, well, no, you're counting discrete things. And so here's the count of things. And that's where it gets problematic. It's like, well, no, wait, because the deterministic gave me a number. Probabilistic gives me a range. There's a massive actionability gap there. There's a massive operational gap. Well, no, because the counting wasn't right. The counting wasn't right. It just presented itself as being this utterly precise metric, when it wasn't right. There was obviously misfires,
yeah,
and false positives,
yeah,
right? And so I think, is that something, because it's almost like, okay, well, if I want to convince someone that the gap is actually smaller than it seems, I have to convince them that the way they were doing things before wasn't actually that precise. That feels like a difficult thing to do. Do you ever encounter that issue?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's this famous statistician called John Tukey, and he goes, it's better to have a rough answer. I'm paraphrasing him badly, but it's better to have a rough answer to the right question than a really, really precise answer to the wrong question. Mm-hmm. If you read a bit about psychology of human beings, which we all are, we quite often, if we're thinking about a hard question and we can only get to a woolly answer, we quite often shift in our minds and start answering an easier question to be mm-hmm. precise about. And that is something that, when you're trying to move in the other direction, is really hard, because our minds right. want to go in the more precise, but maybe not exactly the right answer direction. And I mean, you've written about it a little bit, haven't you, about how the platforms aren't as neutral as they seem, and that some of the things that are presented to us as marketers as being absolute fact actually have some kind of biases and some decisions behind them that actually aren't made in the marketer's interest. They're made in the platform's interest.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and I think that should be, I mean, I don't think, and that's not even like a controversial thing to say. That's just if you're talking about human psychology, that's just what humans will do. I mean, given the opportunity. I wrote a piece about this a while back, because it was something I encountered a lot. It's a topic that I talk about a lot when I give presentations. I call it like Wittgenstein's ruler. And this is actually from Nassim Taleb, but he talks about he came up with this concept of Wittgenstein's ruler, and it's like you use a ruler to measure a chair just as much as you could use a chair to measure a ruler, right? And if you don't have a lot of confidence in the thing that's being used to measure something, that thing's output can really just tell you more about the measurement apparatus than the output tells you about what it's measuring, right? And that really resonated with me when I was rereading his book, because I just keep seeing people, it's either vendors or teams, tell me about this attribution system that's totally precise, post-IDFA, totally precise. And that just tells me they don't know what they're doing. The output of those systems doesn't give me any information about the effectiveness of their marketing activities. It gives me total information about their competence. They are incompetent. They don't know how this works. They don't know how the world works, right? And so it's like it's having the opposite effect. I'm not being wowed, right? I'm being dismayed. Oh my God, you don't know how marketing works. Mm-hmm. You don't, because this is impossible anymore. You can't give me a number anymore. You don't have the capability to do that.
This doesn't exist. Yeah.
You're being fooled. You're being hoodwinked.
There's no algorithm that can take garbage in and turn it into perfect answer out.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen.
It doesn't exist.
But that's a good setup to the next question I want to get to, which is when you've seen reluctance to sort of embrace this new way of doing things, right? Like the probabilistic methodologies, where's it usually coming from? Because I've seen it come from the finance team. I think the marketing team gets it. The finance team doesn't. And they've been accustomed to like, I need a number. I need one number. That's what I use to plug into the model. But I had a guest on a while back, Olivia Corey, who works at House. And she said that actually the finance teams are usually the most likely to embrace this stuff. And it's the marketing teams that don't. A, because it could be an indictment of the previous way of doing things. But B, it's because, well, it changes their whole operational process. Because actually the way they do the media buying changes as a result of this. And they'd rather have that synthetic fake approximation of the precise number. Where have you seen the reluctance come from?
I think I've seen more what she's seen, that it's marketing teams that struggle with it. And quite often it's because they've got used to presenting the results this one way. And quite often if you move to a different way of looking at it, it could make it look like marketing isn't quite as effective as we thought before. And nobody wants to present that to their boss. Equally, there might have to be a change in decisions that have been made in the past, and actually nobody wants to go, well, I was wrong then. But we find actually that finance teams really get it. Quite a lot of them have got some economics in their background, and econometrics is a method that's used in the city, in finance, in government, all around the place. And so many finance people go, oh yeah, I know econometrics, and they'll take it on board. But I think the marketing departments find it very difficult.
Yeah, that's interesting to update my priors on this, because that hasn't been my experience. I think it's probably like a different exposure. It's a different group exposure here, mm-hmm. which is because, you know, if you're bringing in like a vendor, that's a very different decision than bringing in someone like me, who would be very, very operational with the marketing team. It'd be the marketing team that knows me to bring me in, right? That's interesting. So I want to explore that a little bit. So you're talking about that there's a difference here in just in the educational background, mm-hmm. or maybe like just call it the skill sets. Finance team has a skill set to understand this. Maybe the marketing team doesn't. Do you generally see a knowledge gap at the CMO level? And I think you just answered this question, but let me dig in the use of econometrics methods for improving marketing efficiency. So do you feel like, and maybe like just to expand that, because I think you just sort of answered that, is the historical CMO profile fit for purpose for the new marketing environment?
Yeah, so it is a good question, because I think, and again, we've got different group exposure here. So probably most of my experiences in the UK and Europe, most CMOs that have spent a decent amount on offline media will know econometrics in Europe, because it's always had that use case, hasn't it? We've never been able to track offline ads like TV, press, radio, whatever with cookies. So that's always been there. Where there is less knowledge, and I think this is what you're kind of pointing to, is that marketers that have grown up in the digital first world, and they're at CMO level now, and even sometimes at really big firms, haven't had that experience of the online and offline mix working together and the need to measure offline. And so for that reason, they kind of haven't come across more probabilistic methods. And actually, that's part of the reason why I got into making training courses, because we see it so often in our evaluation work at Magic Numbers that a client will rock up and they can be actually really over invested in performance media because they've been relying on signals that tell you to do that, right? And we've got lots and lots of different types of business, and we can see it almost by looking at their spending data. Like for your type of business, that's too much performance. And it's definitely visible in our econometrics results when they work with us. But those businesses have got a journey to go on. And there's some realizations that have to happen. There's some cogs that have to turn in people's minds and some quite hairy meetings that have got to be gotten through in that organization before the needed change can happen. That climb down from that position that you've got to by taking the attribution figures really literally.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think there's a lot there. Maybe we just hover there for a second. So that's a really good point. I hadn't really considered it. It's the CPG, CMOs, the big brands, this is nothing new to them. Mm-hmm. Nothing really changed. It's like, okay, there's some proportion of our spend on digital. We lost some signal there, but we were doing we were using econometrics anyway.
Many of them, yeah.
So the loss of signal there maybe makes on an operational level, like in the working in the Facebook ads manager, maybe that makes that a little bit more unclear, but from a measurement standpoint, we've been doing this for forever.
Right, exactly.
And so forgive me, but it's redolent of that meme template of the guy with the noose around his neck. And the other guy next to him, he's like, first time? Well, that's the CPG CMO is like, well, this is your first time losing signal? We had never had signal. Welcome to our world. But that's really interesting. So really, it's the digital teams that are kind of operating at a disadvantage, because this is like a fundamental shift in the way they've had to do things. And the sort of like big brand CPG type CMOs, well, it's okay. We're losing some signal, but for the most part, we operate a big chunk of our budget without it. And so we know how to do that. It's just expanding the sort of surface area of our measurement tools to this new channel or this new set of channels. But for the most part, we're already oriented around doing that, because probably digital wasn't the primary channel in the first place.
Or it wasn't the only thing. It can be the primary channel if you're a bank or an energy company, sure, where people are searching online, but you're also doing TV or posters and things like that. And you've got a way to analyze those. And actually, I hope that this change that we're all going through might kind of get to a point where, because people have got these measurement techniques that don't require tracking and don't require cookies, actually, we've got a way that we could try doing posters or TV or radio, right, or something. And now we can see whether that works for us. And I think that's going to open up some options for some people. That's going to improve things.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a post about this a while back called Flying Blind. And the point is, like, so I talk about this, there's this aviator. He was the first ever aviator to fly literally blind. The airplane was one of those with like an open cockpit, and he put a sack over his head. And because he had built a lot of the tools that are needed to fly without visibility. So he had built like the artificial horizon and a couple of other tools that allowed him to do that. And he wanted to prove that you didn't need physical visibility to fly a plane. You could do it like literally flying blind and no visibility. And so that's scary. It's a scary thing to do. I wouldn't want to be the first person to do that. But the benefit to doing that was that, well, okay, now you can fly when you have no visibility. If you don't need visibility, then you don't need to fly during, you don't only need to fly during the day. You don't only need to fly during clear conditions, but you can fly whenever you want. Like, it just opens up new opportunities to fly. Like, and my point was with the analogy is that, well, the same is true here. Like, if we no longer have the visibility of that paper trail, of that set of artifacts that go from click to app install to purchase, or click to website landing page to add to cart to purchase, you no longer have that, and you need to build all this instrumentation to just sort of like a proxy for it or estimate it, well, then you have a lot more opportunities to advertise, because not every single channel offered that in the first place. Like, so you know, I would say, like, the world is your billboard. The world is your advertising surface. If you don't need that paper trail, you don't need that auditable series of artifacts in order to do measurement, well, then you can advertise anywhere. That just opens up opportunities that weren't previously available to you in influencer, in podcasts, right? In TV, in radio, in out of home, like a whole universe of places to advertise that you never previously tried because they were foreclosed to you because your measurement system was entirely predicated on that paper trail of artifacts for deterministic measurement. So it is, in a way, it's exciting.
Yeah. And there are some really effective things in that list that you just came up with. And
yeah,
knowing what we know, we sit across a couple of meta studies that have got lots and lots of results from these econometric type analyses. And you can really see some of those options are fantastic for people that sell online. If you put a TV ad, people quite often watch them with their phone in their hands, and you can just go straight through and buy. And that's a really effective thing to do. And we're seeing influencer come through as a really important channel, in because it's very trusted. People trust influencers in a way that they don't trust lots of other content. And that, again, is something that's emerging as quite a effective channel that actually you couldn't know that before.
And also it's TV. It's if you think about the most rapidly expanding advertising category, it's CTV, right? I mean, there are no new social channels emerging for advertising. I mean, it's stuck in like a permanent stasis, I think. There will not be, unless you consider that to be new. But CTV is exciting. You got Netflix, you got Disney Plus, you got Amazon Prime. These are totally new opportunities. They're totally new surface areas. I mean, these are a year plus old. Netflix, November, to Disney Plus, December. Amazon Prime Video is 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
Right.
These are totally new greenfield opportunities, and which would have been inconceivable to advertise on for a deterministic oriented marketer, but now present opportunity if they've made the transition, which a lot haven't, unfortunately, but I mean, it's happening. It's very slow. I think it's more of a, it's in a lot of ways, it's like a tools transition. It's an infrastructure transition. It's a cultural transition. And those tend to be much slower, right? Than if you just need to adopt some new tool, that's pretty easy.
Yeah. I think the cultural part of it is what makes it slower. I mean, technology always moves faster than culture, doesn't it? And then government, right, the slowest of all. I agree with that. And sometimes it takes a turnover of people in the team, like some churn, before that can happen. Like a new senior marketer comes in and goes, right, we're going to do it differently. And we're seeing that a lot. Actually, we're getting a huge number of D2Cs come knocking on our door at the moment going, we need to do this. And it's quite often a new person in the team.
Right, right. Yeah. I've seen the same. Okay. So as we talked about how the application of econometrics to marketing measure, it's not new. CPG companies have been doing this for decades, going back to, I don't know if you're a fan of Mad Men, but there was the story arc where they're bringing in the computer, right? And they're like, everyone's worried because like, oh, this will help us measure the TV ads, right? Mm-hmm. We need this big computer to do the statistical analysis. I mean, I think that part of the series was set in the 50s or early 60s or something, but it's not new, right? I mean, this is decades old, and the media mix models are decades old, 50, 60 years. So this has been, CPG companies, big brands have been doing this for decades, but what added benefit does the generally more immediate and granular availability of data provide to econometric measurement for digital first advertisers? Because like, if you think about a CPG brand, you've got exogenous effects, you've got kind of macro factors, you got money out, you got ad spend, you got geo level ad spend, slow, that's all very high level. Digital first, I mean, if you are switching to this, you do have more. There's lower altitude data, lower altitude signals. How does that help? How does that provide more value to this approach?
It helps a lot. It really does. And just, you're right, it has been going on for a long time, media marketing mix modeling. In the UK, it was done by ad agencies back in the 80s and 90s. And the generation before me was kind of busy getting printouts from dot matrix printers and putting them into Excel version 1.0. And through all the years since then, actually, the industry has been learning, the MMM, econometrics industry, about how to get the best results from the technique, about how to get it slicker and faster and more reliable. But progress has really accelerated, as you say, with more granular data and more detailed findings. And that's because of the oodles more data that you can get in much better shape, and the technology for getting it all wrangled and ready to go is brilliant. APIs and AI being used to handle code and all those kind of things. And I guess my advice for anyone that's thinking about it is that you want a provider that's got some roots in the longer history of econometrics, but that's also using really, really modern methods, because then they've got the handed down wisdom from the years before, but they're not that type of old school. There are some old school providers out there that will even lump all digital together into one variable, which is just frightening. But also at the other end of the scale, there's kind of some providers that are so new to it that they've been doing it for sort of 6 months or something. And some of them are providing solutions that are kind of baking in some of the same kinds of problems that last click attribution has, because they haven't got that history with the technique. So the way you can tell if a provider's falling into that trap is if they don't ask for data on all drivers of your sales. Because if it's an econometrics model, it needs data on all drivers of your sales, otherwise it will get it wrong. So that's how to kind of, I guess, some tips there to kind of balance out what you're if you're thinking about how to shop for it in a way.
Yeah, it's super, it's pretty helpful. And I've seen that. I've seen like digital be a line item. I'm like, what are you talking about? This you can't do that.
God, it's outrageous. Yeah. You're like, what? Yeah.
Okay, so kind of diving more into the specifics, what are some of the econometric methods and frameworks that you utilize in your work? And what kind of tools work very well in the marketing measurement context?
So we keep our methods as simple as possible, and we only go for really complex econometric techniques when the situation absolutely like requires it. Because like even the simplest econometrics itself is a powerful tool, and there's a whole kind of academic literature and a toolkit that surrounds it that's kind of there and available to use. And what we've understood from our years of experience with it and handed down wisdom from generations before is that the complex econometrics is less important, and it's not going to take you as far forward as having the right set of hands kind of using the tools. So the effort that the person using econometrics makes to understand the world that the business experiences is more important than how kind of techie and complex the actual econometric methods being used are. So it's never going to be a perfect representation. It's always going to be a sort of simplified version of a stylized map. But what we prioritize in our practice is ensuring that our models line up with what the business already knows, whether it's A/B tests or market research or what analysts are saying about how the category is moving. That combined with the right amount of complexity and methods is going to get you to the reliable findings. So we use high tech stuff for kind of data wrangling and managing our findings and all of those kinds of things. But we're quite human in the way that we actually build the models, because we kind of think that you need to have human reasoning to be able to take the outside world and build a model that looks like it.
Two kind of follow-up questions. So when you say the hands that are using, does that also accommodate for just knowledge of the category? So like obviously, you know, a practiced, experienced economist, you'd expect to have that running the process, but also just like knowledge of the category is probably very helpful. So like understanding, okay, this doesn't pass a smell test. This, we're probably not getting all of our, probably affiliate is not responsible for 90% of sales or something. Cause that just generally doesn't happen with whatever dating apps or something. Like just knowing the categories, that's part of that experience you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some things that are common to categories that you learn over years of doing this kind of thing. And there are also things that might be relevant from that category in this category at this point in time because of the context that they happen to find themselves in. So all of those kind of things are being brought into it.
Yeah. And so the other follow-up question. So very, very good point about the sophistication of the models generally being something that detracts from rather than contributes to the analysis. When I used to like run these teams, I would always find it irritating when some analyst comes with a very complex model to describe something that probably doesn't need it, right? And instead of just going for the much more straightforward approach, but it's part of the reason for that. That's just generally the right way to do things. Like the more data you have, like generally the less sophisticated model you need. But as part of that, also that sort of like preference for simplicity is part of it. Also a function of having to explain this to clients. And so like the more challenging it is or the more complex or inscrutable it is, it's like the more skeptical they'll be. Is that also part? And you know, this could be either we're talking about like a third party vendor relationship or even just internally trying to sell this up. Is that a friction that you encounter?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Just it's the right way to do science, isn't it? Just don't make the method more complex unless you have to. And that's true everywhere that, you know, that there's learning going on with data. But I fundamentally agree that things that you do to evaluate marketing should be possible to explain to normal people who didn't like maths at school and people who are kind of got half their brain on their kids or they're tired today. They should still be able to get it. And So part of the thing with keeping it simple is to help explain it. But I think there's also a skill, which is explaining complex things to normal people and talking to them like you talk to a friend in the pub, or that sort of thing is an important skill and is lacking a little bit in marketing science and effectiveness. You know, we did market research and spoke to a lot of different people that use marketing effectiveness analysis, and quite often they said, yeah, I talked to the vendors and they just made me feel stupid. And we were like, oh my God, that's awful. Cause you don't want to feel stupid, do you? You can't use something that makes you feel stupid.
Yeah. And I also just, I'm circumspect when someone comes and it's like, oh, look, you can't understand this. It's too complicated. Oh, okay. Try me. Right. Like, I mean, if you can't explain it, then you probably don't understand it. I remember earlier in my career, I was working at this gaming company and I flew in to the headquarters. I was living in Helsinki and I developed this LTV model and I was presenting it to like the management. And the CEO just kind of like almost like called, like when I got to this point, because it was a very, very divisive topic in the company, which I mean, it is generally most companies. I want to say divisive. It's just fraught. There's a lot of
tricky.
It's tricky. It's challenging to navigate because there's a lot of, you know, commercial value stored in that number. So basically, like end of the meeting, I was going through it and answering all these questions. It was a really complex model. We were obviously mired in the complexity of this. Like, this meeting was not productive at that point. It was not moving forward. And he sort of like called an end of the meeting and then just lambasted me for like 30 minutes. And I was like pretty junior. I was like straight out of grad school almost, which to be fair, it was not the right approach to use. And then he's like, okay, let's do this. You have no access to a calculator or a spreadsheet or whatever to make this calculation. We're just going to do it on the whiteboard. You tell me some revenue numbers and I'll use my approach. You use your approach. And so like, And he just did this like curve that he fit to it. It's like, okay, like here's what I would do. This is it. And I'm like sitting there trying to like do calculus. And you know, it was unpleasant. And I felt like maybe that wasn't the right interaction method. But anyway, it instilled in me a deep appreciation for making things simple and clear and easy to understand and easy to communicate.
Fewer things in each unit of communication, isn't it? It's kind of,
right.
Don't tell me kind of everything. Don't boil the ocean in this meeting. Just tell me kind of a couple of steps towards where we need to get to.
Right, exactly.
The most important one.
Yeah, apologies for turning this into a therapy session, but I came to mind and I hadn't thought about that in years and years. Okay, so how does the measurement cadence change when a marketing team makes a transition from deterministic to econometric measurement? Because I think that you can't do it with that the same sort of like immediacy.
No, yeah. And again, it's that point about if you've got an MTA-shaped hole, you're not going to fill it in this new world with an MTH shaped thing, because you can do monthly econometrics or even weekly, but actually adding an extra month or an extra week doesn't usually add that much. And the reason is because the technique is using variation over time to identify stable relationships between these causal variables and sales. So if it's doing its job right, one additional week's worth of data isn't going to change those stable relationships. So actually you should only really need to kind of do a new version of it when you've tried something new and you want to know what the relationship between that and sales is. So what we usually recommend, and most of our clients do, is 6 months, once every 6 months, and then those stable relationships should hold over the next 6 months. And if you're changing your media plan a lot and quickly, do it more often so that you can evaluate the new things. But if you've got quite a stable thing and you're changing one or two things in the 6 months, then you don't need to do it more often than that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, so I think in a lot of ways, I mean, like when I was running like U18s in gaming, for instance, we were making changes on the basis of like D0 ROAS, right? D0 predicted ROAS, right? So that day, the money we made that day, how did that map to expectations? How did that map to the model? And then what changes could we make as a result of that? And the platforms can't really react that fast. I mean, you can make the changes that fast, but they can't react that fast. They're still looking at it. They still have look back windows. And then the other thing is like, do you want to operate like that? Like, it's okay. I think my sense is like in a lot of ways, we've maybe fooled ourselves into thinking that was actually productive, because the bigger picture is probably better to find reliable things that work for more than a day, right? I mean, it's one thing if you're changing bids. And to be fair, I mean, like that on a platform like Meta or Facebook or Instagram or whatever, like, yeah, that could be relevant. But if you're like making creative decisions every day, well, that's not sustainable. Like you can't scale that. That's subscale. That's you're stuck in a local maximum. Right? Like that's not going to scale to like, if you've got these creative changes that literally just exhaust in a day, Well, then, what are you going to do? Hire 1,000 creative? I mean, maybe with AI it changes or something, but that's not the only thing. It's like, well, the model, you can't update the model every day. It's you're going to be capturing noise. You're just basically updating on the basis of noise.
Well, if your view of what works changes every day, you're kind of playing. Do you have whack-a-mole over there?
Yeah.
You're just playing whack-a-mole. You're going
right.
And actually, you're responding to something that's moving too much.
Right.
And it's become quite labor intensive. Before AI, it was very labor intensive, all this stuff. And I always looked at kind of teams doing it, thinking it's quite a lot of people to look after all of this.
And that operational complexity can become debilitating.
Yeah.
You know, so like even if you take the creative component out of it, because hey, we've got LLM, we've got text to image AI models now, and that's fine. Okay, but still, all the other pieces. So first of all, if you could very well be reacting to noise, that's actually not indicative, right? I mean, that's just a general approach and statistics you'd want to take. You'd want to make sure you're getting enough data to make sure that you're not specifically reacting to just noise. But the other, it's like, okay, well, if we are going to try to react every, it's like thrashing. It's not considered movement, right? It's just thrash. It's just purely a response to changing outputs that might not reflect the underlying trend, right? And
yeah, because I think we call it CPA, cost per acquisition. So I know it's CAC over there, but you'd be going, if that's going up and down all the time, why is it going up or down all the time?
Right.
Because the platform's not suddenly becoming less effective than it was yesterday.
Right.
It's because the outside world is changing. And wouldn't you rather just have an understanding of what the platform does and what the outside world does
in your life
that's stable and that you can plan with?
Right, yeah. And it's, yeah, because the platform's also not changing meaningfully in terms of like the composition of people that are on it every day, right? Especially if you think about a platform like Facebook, 3.6 billion daily active people or something. So it's pretty stable. Like
slowly aging, but yeah.
Yeah, slowly aging, but it's the passage of time is the determinant there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so does the adoption of econometric measurement frameworks necessitate a closer integration between the marketing team and the product team concerning things like pricing, promotions, audience development, all the things that the product team is doing all the time, right, to improve the product? When you're using these probabilistic methods, econometric methods, do the marketing team need to be much more apprised of what they're doing and maybe even have some sort of input there? Is that helpful? Is there a closeness that gets instigated by this transition?
Yes, there is. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And it's because marketing should have a closer understanding of what else drives sales. It isn't just ads and kind of placements on platforms. It's the whole marketing mix, so all of the different things that affect whether someone buys or not. And actually, if you can coordinate those things, you do the right kind of amplification of the right kind of price change, then what all of our models show is that is the thing that can be a game changer in marketing. Either of those things separately can do a good job, but together they're really powerful.
Got it. And so last question, let's say that some enterprising high school student emails you in a week's time and says, Dr. Kite, I listened to your podcast and I want to do what you do. I want to do what you do in my career. And I'm graduating this summer or whatever. And I'm going to go to college. What should I study? What should I study to do what you do? And then what kind of job should I get? What should my first job be? If I want to be a marketing economist, I want to apply these econometric models and methods to marketing, because I just think that's really fascinating. What should I study and what should I do? What experiences should I gain and what education should I attain to do what you do?
So you study economics. That's what my PhD is in, and that's what everybody in my team has studied. You could also study statistics or maths or something like that. You need to kind of understand the models themselves. I think people have a funny idea of what economists actually do. They think it's about finance or government policy or unemployment or something. But really, those are just domain areas that economics can be applied to, because it really economics is a toolkit. And it's a set of tools that allow you to have theories about what will happen based on like logic or principles or knowledge about how businesses and people behave. And then the toolkit also allows you to test those using statistics. And that's the sort of behaviors that a marketing economist will do. We'll have theories about the way the world works. They have to have a kind of working knowledge of the theories of marketing and the theories of consumer choice and the theories of demand curves and things like that, and be able to apply those and see what's working in which of those applies in this particular context, and using data to do that, and then see what the answer is. And I think it's a brilliant set of things to do. I would love it if a high school student emailed me, and we take interns that do that all the time, because I think it's a fantastic set of things to be able to do. It's getting order out of chaos, and it's like revealing that path to growth.
Yeah, I mean, I think what attracted me to this space, because I was in finance originally and then moved into like just consumer tech and, you know, I'm on the analytics side. But what really attracted me to performance marketing was it just combines a lot of things that are really interesting. It's you got the big data, right?
Yeah.
You've got the sort of application of statistical modeling. And you have a very immediate impact, right? Like if you're doing marketing well that day, your product grows, right? Yeah. And you're spending money. That's the other thing. What I like about being in the performance marketing team and the user acquisition team, whatever you want to call it, is that you're spending a lot of money. A lot of times startups is the biggest line item on the in the company's like expense sheet. And so you're front and center. You're spending that much money. You're not some small sort of ancillary sort of function. You're right there. Everyone's looking at what you're doing. It's really important. And I always kind of thought of economics. So my master's degree is in economics. And I always thought of it as an exercise in optimally allocating scarce resources. Well, what better manifestation of that is there than marketing? Money's scarce. On any given day, money's scarce. You have to optimally allocate it in the way that best supports the product's growth. It just seems like such a natural fit.
I love that. You're like me. Done a lot of education and got a PhD and everything, but kind of didn't want to live in the theoretical world. I really want to see change happen in the world. And that's where marketing is. You can see that. You can see businesses grow from the work that you do.
Right. And it's super fulfilling.
Yeah.
Grace, this was a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed it. What I'd like you to do is, first of all, please plug your course.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do offer training, and it's super practical, super modern, full of frameworks, simple things you can do with data that you've already got. And whether you love maths or not, it's all doable for you. And one of my courses is about optimizing performance marketing for growth and incrementality. And it's aimed at performance-only businesses or scale-ups. And what it does is it covers how to make good first steps into top-of-funnel advertising, avoiding some of the types of mistakes that digital first businesses often make when they first start to do kind of TV or start using YouTube in a brand first way. So it covers that transition that you can make into having a more varied media mix. And the other is just about using data to inform marketing more generally. So two courses there, and they're both starting up in the scale-ups one is starting up in the next couple of weeks, and we've got another one towards the end of April. So I'd love to see some of your audience join up in our spring cohorts. They can check magicworks.training, or they can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. That's Grace Kite. And I think we're going to send a lovely discount code to your Slack group.
That's right. There will be a discount code shared in the Slack group when this is published. So stay tuned for that. And I will link to the training URLs in the show notes.
Thank you.
Grace, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I think the audience will find this conversation as enlightening as I did. And I wish you a very happy weekend.
Thank you.